Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good afternoon. I'm Lewis Friedberg, and I'm a senior reporter and advisor to California Watch, which is a new reporting venture covering California, supported by various California foundations. And hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about what we're doing, because I think it relates very much to the theme of this panel. Unfortunately, the designated moderator was unable to get here today, and he sends his apologies, and so I've stepped in. And so we're going to actually have a more of a free-flowing kind of conversation. We are now not bound by the prejudices and preconceived notions of any moderator, which I think is appropriate for the discussion today, which is nominally we're going to be talking about the fate of print journalism and the new information technologies and what that means for democracy in California and the country. So, and I'm sure all of you have things to say about this subject. Before I introduce the panel, I was just talking the other day with my 8-year-old and 11-year-old, and we started to speculate about all the things that didn't exist when their parents that exist now that didn't exist when their parents were growing up. You know, and we sort of started with there were no VCRs. And there were certainly no cell phones, and we used turntables, and et cetera, et cetera. There was quite a lengthy list. But then we morphed onto things that exist today that didn't exist when they were born. And there was quite a substantial list. You know, iPhones, for example, smartphones, Google, which one of our panelists has written an entire book on. In the last less than 10 years, there have been enormous transformations, not intergenerational, but within generations, that things are happening at such an extraordinary pace, at a pace that's really unparalleled in human history. And we are in the middle of this, and there's no area has the change been more fundamental than in information technology and information distribution, and of course with profound implications for the media. And one of the things that I worked at the San Francisco Chronicle for about 15 years, and other nonprofit journalism ventures, there's something extremely daunting but amazingly creative to be in an environment that is changing daily. There are things that are happening today that we could absolutely not have anticipated. I mean, just in the last few weeks, I mean, who could have predicted, and I may get some reaction, but the most innovative media company this week, is AOL, which has bought Huffington Post, and then there's this local network called Patch. We've all heard about all the layoffs in journalism and so on, but Patch is hiring 1,000 journalists across the country, 1,000. And it's the center of a tremendous debate. So this is the kind of, this couldn't have been predicted 6 months ago, that AOL would have bought Huffington Post, and everybody is trying to figure out what
that means. Do we
really
want to call the purchase of a company innovation?
Well, okay.
As long as we're being immoderate.
Right. No, that's what they do in
the moderator to answer the question that he posed.
It's the drug company.
Well, I'm going to get to that.
Model.
I'm going to ask you that as the first question.
So the purchase of the company with stock, in fact. Which is
so let me introduce the panel before they really just take over the whole show. Yeah. The person who posed that question was Siva Vaidyanathan, who is professor of media studies and law at the University of Virginia. And he's written a book, which I think has one of the best titles, certainly of the year, which is called The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. He's also written The Anarchist in the Library, How the Clash Between Freedom and Control is Hacking the Real World and Crashing the System. So we're looking forward to hearing from him. And the first question we're going to ask is, does buying a company represent innovation? Next to him, let me get my... is Tara McPherson, who is an associate professor of gender and critical studies at USC's School of Cinematic Arts. She is the author of the award-winning reconstruction Dixie, Race, Gender, and Nostalgia in the Imagined South. She's also editor of Digital Youth, and she is also the founding editor of Vectors, a multimedia peer-reviewed journal. And I'd like to hear more about that. So thanks for joining the panel. And then finally, Leif Haase, who has kindly taken the seat that Joaquin Alvarado isn't here to fill. And we're thrilled that Leif and I go back several years. He is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He is a former director of the California program. He was a senior program officer at the 20th Century Foundation, and his major focus is on health reform in California nationally, and has made substantial contributions both here and nationally to the debate. And one of the issues he is grappling is, how do you engage the public and policymakers in serious policy reforms? I guess that's a given. You want to get the policymakers engaged, but that's not always a given when you're involved in policy. So I'm going to start with that question. Okay. We're talking about the Googleization of America, but AOL has also been a substantial a force, right. And Huffington Post has probably been one of the most successful new platform. It's hard to know what to call it, because they've been a news aggregator, blog, a site. So
to get this story down, we have to understand that the pervasiveness of Google, its influence on our economy, on our decision making, on our information seeking, can't be underestimated, right? That's why I wrote the book and why you should read it. But beyond that, let's understand that because Google is habitually, and I think that's the right word, habitually our first stop for seeking information, any site that can crack Google, can reverse engineer the decisions that Google's algorithms make, is going to succeed in the Google universe, is going to find its links higher in the list of search results for many important searches. That's pretty obviously understood within the web world. In the last few years, we've seen a number of firms rise with the explicit goal of landing high on Google search results. That seems to be their only goal. So at the most craven end of that are companies like Demand Media, right? So if you type in a basic question about a medical condition, or a basic question about Charlie Sheen, you're likely to get fairly high in the search results a link to a Demand Media.
And when you say Demand Media, you mean generically?
No, it's a company called Demand Media.
Could you just explain that?
And that's what I'm getting. So what Demand Media does is it's a content farm. It's not really a journalistic institution. It pays people very little money, but at least something, to just produce text. And the text has to contain keywords that are frequently searched on Google. The whole purpose of having someone write this text is to produce the page that someday someone will click to, and ideally click through an advertisement on that page. But in the meantime, it's all about attracting eyeballs. So Demand Media is the most extreme version of this method of playing Google. Just above Demand Media, sort of the moral ladder, is Huffington Post. Huffington Post, obviously, right, we know that it does actually pay a handful of people to produce real journalism. It's a very small handful of people, and it's barely real journalism. But they do pay people something. The vast majority of people who produce content for Huffington Post do so for no money, right? So it's not an ideal labor situation. It's one of the reasons I sort of recoil when liberals like myself speak of Huffington Post affectionately. It's a horrible labor situation. On top of that, there's a vast quantity of Huffington produced stories that are not actually Huffington produced stories. They're merely one or two paragraphs lifted from local and independent news sources and repurposed on Huffington's page with a link to the original, but that hardly matters because Huffington Post has mastered what we call search engine optimization, the ability to position oneself within Google's search engine. So a search for almost any news story in the world, including Charlie Sheen, will show up, will generate a Huffington Post link fairly high.
How do they do that?
It's magic. Well, yes, they do. They do it the following way. First of all, they make sure that keywords that are likely to be searched are repeated. Just before the Super Bowl this last year, Huffington Post produced a story called "What Time Is the Super Bowl On?" knowing that millions of people would go to Google and type in "What Time Is the Super Bowl On?"
I actually did that.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't want to see any of the run-up. I want to see when it starts at 6:23. Yeah.
And the Huffington Post story was top, right? So, it's brilliant. They figure out what are people going to search for. Both Huffington and Domain Media do this. And then they produce content.
So it's a
very little cost.
It's a conscious process.
It's a conscious process.
Trying to figure out how.
Right.
When somebody goes on Google.
So Huffington is the most successful of these. Domain Media is successful, but they had a big IPO, so somebody thinks it's worth something. Huffington Post, because it's quasi-journalistic, is probably a better model, and that's why AOL felt it was worth spending, I think it was $315 million on this company. There's a lesson here for journalism in general, and it's not a good lesson. And that is structure. The imperative is structure one's own menu to bow to Google's biases, to try to play the Google game. So every major publication except the Wall Street Journal is basically bowing to Google's wishes in terms of the structuring of its headlines, the entering of keywords and tags, the effort to push stories out into Twitter so they can also be harvested by Google as Google harvests Twitter feeds. All of this is being engineered in the code of the stories, and they're making editorial decisions based on the likelihood of certain stories showing up high in Google searches, right? So journalism is being Googleized, right? So now, Google has to do what Google does. Google's recognized, and in the past week, it's actually instituted a very public set of changes to try to downgrade content farms like Demand Media, and to some degree, to a lesser degree, Huffington. I ran a series of searches early this morning to see how much Huffington Post stories were still showing up very high, and they were still in the top three for almost every news-based search I could find. Demand Media seems to have disappeared from many of my searches, but no test of Google is scientific, so you can't really tell. So what I'm saying is basically the power of Google is altering journalistic decisions at every level.
Yeah. But just to clarify, with Huffington Post, what's coming up on Google, are those their original articles, their blog posts, or their links to other news outlets?
All three. Yeah. So last year at...
So that's not necessarily a bad thing. I've written something and that pops up, it's on Huffington Post... Oh, it's linked to my story.
It is a bad thing because no one will click on the link to your story. They'll stay on the Huffington Post site, and Huffington Post will make all the advertising money. So last year there was a grisly murder at the University of Virginia, and it was national news, lots of coverage. The daily updates on the story were done almost entirely by my local newspaper, the Charlottesville Daily Progress. They had a tremendous amount of effort put into it, and a very small staff. They did an outstanding job covering this very sensitive story. Every single one of their stories was picked up by Huffington Post, and that became the story that everyone was tweeting and retweeting. That became the Huffington Post version of the story, became the one that was first on Google searches. So the Charlottesville Daily Progress benefited not at all from having its content essentially reharvested by Huffington.
I'd say there's another story embedded in this that I think extends across the kind of digital economies we're seeing unfolding that I think is really interesting to take up, and it applies to journalism, what's happening to it, but it applies in a lot of other places as well. This kind of ability and force of the digital to harvest content also is harvesting labor, right? Yeah. So many things that used to be imaginable as careers in which you might work and sustain a living wage, digital economies imagine now kind of structure as labor done for free. It may be done for pleasure, but it's still done for free. So, you know, my husband owned a video game company that when they couldn't finish the code for a project, they would open source it, something we typically think of as a good thing, right? And guys at home who really liked roller coaster games would write the code for free, you know, at night and give it back to the company, right? And that could be a fan economy, but it could also be a pretty profound reorganization of labor in the U.S. right now that we might want to stop and think about, right? And I don't think it's dissociated from what's happening in Wisconsin as we speak, that learning to harvest labor for free, you know, that we might call content, is connected to learning to, you know, dismantle unions so that we have no way to organize around labor and a living wage.
Leaf, I guess one of the, I mean, this is a big area, but what is this different way we're getting content? Does what about the quality of the content? I mean, and I just to dissent a little bit. I mean, from in terms of what we are doing, you know, when Huffington Post carries one of our stories, they don't carry the whole story, and there's a link back to our site. So they actually are driving some traffic to our site, which is part of the trade-off in this whole content distribution. And why, you know, do you want your link to your article to be on Google? Probably Yahoo. Yahoo takes our material. Now, Yahoo, by the way, is the biggest, as the largest largest audience of any news site. They get 40 million uniques a month. It's huge. The New York Times gets 20 million. This is something that, you know, I wasn't aware of until I started talking to Yahoo. And so when they pick up one of our pieces, there's a link to our site, and they do drive traffic to our site. But they don't pay us for it. There are these trade-offs. But.
Well, I'd answer that by saying that, in by way of a little bit of background, that at New America we've sort of lived the transformation that in the media, and you know, also by way of full disclosure, Eric Schmidt of Google is our board chair, which is not in his all-powerful Google hat, but simply as an individual. We were founded basically as a media strategy to promote big ideas and mostly big, unpopular, unknown ideas. And the way that we were going to do it, this was back in the late 90s, was to basically colonize other people's media streams, and mostly with op-eds. I mean, the idea was to get lots of folks to write op-eds, not to build a big apparatus, to do it on the cheap and use other people to get our ideas across. And what happened, and this gets a little bit to the quality issue as well, is that the media stream started to dry up, or at least the traditional print media streams dried up considerably. So what we were left with was moving over all our fellows, all our staff, into the other new areas. And so in the last 3 years in California, we've been heavily involved, pretty prolific, 1,500 articles, op-eds, and you know other shorter pieces. But we've gone from being less interested in having something published, say, in the Daily Beast, to being happy that it's in the Daily Beast. I mean, we might have said before, boy, we want to have it in Newsweek. And then the Daily Beast becomes Newsweek. So that's rather a remarkable transformation. But, we're very much, when I want to hear you talk about the labor issues, and I really appreciate that, and it's a very good point. I mean, we've really been in the camp, since we're, you know, largely funded through other sources, of trying to, you know, get out the information and getting out the ideas through whichever way we can. And if you do that with links, if you do that with tweets, you know, every sort of publicity is good, and we always embrace it. But and haven't thought probably enough about some of the consequences.
But just to clarify, are you saying you're moving more into the online distribution?
Very much.
Because these other outlets are drying up?
Because the other outlets are drying up, and you can't be sure that you'll get the volume. You know, precisely because we're trying to make a difference on the idea side. We're trying to, you know, pass certain kinds of health reform or education reform or governance reform in California. And you actually have to, I mean, this is true of, as you know, for reporters too, you have to wear many hats. You can't just wear one hat. I mean, there's, you know, 30, 40 years ago, there was Walter Lippmann. Walter Lippmann wrote his column for The Post, and everybody read that column, and that was his one hat. I mean, now Walter Lippmann would have to have, you know, a Twitter feed. He'd have to have various, you know, television shows, and that would be necessary. And even if he didn't have to do that, he'd feel he needed to do it because of peer pressure.
But I have a feeling
can I just clarify? But when you said it's drying up, why is that? Is it there are fewer outlets, or people they're not interested?
The outlets tend to be more local. They tend to be either too big or too small. They're either hyper-localized, in which case the sort of state-level and national-level issues don't get as much of a play, or they're, you know, very, very high levels, so the sort of policy and, you know, issues that we're interested in don't get as much of a hearing.
If there was one American who was immune to peer pressure, it was Walter Lippmann.
Absolutely.
So the notion that you have to be everywhere at once is a labor challenge that journalists have been aware of and encountering for about a decade. And I think it's one of the sort of untold stories of the shifts in journalism. The fact is, if you work for the Tribune Company, if you're lucky enough to still work for the Tribune Company, and there aren't many who do, you're expected now to do four or five jobs. Mm-hmm. You're expected to be ready to produce instant online content as well as your daily story for whatever shell of a newspaper still remains under the Tribune banner. And you might actually be expected to sweep up Wrigley Field later, right? So there's in addition to being active in social media, which is about in some cases promotion, in some cases gathering of information, but it is a tremendously grinding process to be a professional journalist right now. It's one of the major reasons that I am an ex-journalist right now, and I think why a lot of people are ex-journalists. Many people left the field because they lost their job, and many people left the field because it's deeply unsatisfying. The deprofessionalization of journalism, I think, is one of these stories, and the erosion of journalists' professional standing and status of labor is something that's going to have tremendous repercussions. And again, like when we see teachers make a stand, I think all of us who have seen the labor standards of Americans erode steadily over the last two decades are just grateful that somebody's taking a stand.
And just to clarify, what kind of journalism did you do before?
Mediocre journalism.
Back the rest of that.
I was a newspaper reporter back in the 20th century, and I did. I worked for three underachieving daily newspapers in Texas. Covered this Texas state capitol for the most part, but I also did a lot of local coverage for one of those papers. I was a professional journalist for about 5 years in various capacities.
Mm-hmm. Can I just comment on that? I'll step out of the moderator role. Why should we care that journalists have to do, in many, many places, have to do many things? And I should say, we are in Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles Times is a Tribune newspaper. And even though the newsroom has been cut almost in more than half, from 1,250 to I think it's under 600 today, the LA Times is still by far the largest newsroom in California, mm-hmm. and does qualify as a functioning newspaper. With 500 or 600 people in a newsroom, you can still do a hell of a job. Actually, a lot of newspapers are finding you can do quite a job with even less than that. And there is a question that there, you know, a lot of newspapers, it was a lot of redundancy built in. You know, do you need to have somebody sitting in the newsroom on a weekend, as I did for quite a few weekends, where I had to call around the police departments, you know, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to find out basically if anybody had been killed. You know, anything less than that, they weren't really interested in. But and so often, that's what the main thing I would do on the weekend. And no article, nothing resulted from that. And that costs money. But the fate of the Tribune Company is very much in question. And actually, it has great repercussions for California because the LA Times, despite the tremendous cutbacks there, is still incredibly important for information flow in California, as are the other remaining newspapers.
Yeah. But let's be clear. The Tribune Company was not in financial trouble and is not in financial trouble because of redundancy in the workroom. It's in financial trouble because of obscene and ridiculous levels of debt that the management ran up for more than a decade. And when the latest management came in, the management system actually increased the debt. I mean, it was a series of profound and boneheaded moves by management that then labor has to pay for. Now, there is – let's also be clear when we talk about the sort of the perceived fall of American daily journalism, that in the past 24 months, I can't think of one American newspaper that's folded. There was a six-month period of time when there was a lot of retrenchment, when Denver lost one of its papers, when Seattle lost one of its papers. But similar things happened in the recession of 1991-92. We had another series of daily newspapers, two paper towns becoming one paper towns, including Atlanta, El Paso, San Diego. I mean, there were a number of things in that retrenchment. So that's not unusual. We haven't seen any more closures since. We've seen a lot of layoffs, despite no closures. There is, in fact, a story of a daily newspaper that continues to survive despite a bad economy, despite a bad advertising market, and that's the Buffalo News. And the Buffalo News is owned by Warren Buffett. It never went crazy on building up debt. It never went crazy on trying to expand into new markets and do new things. It never tried to have a major online presence. And it has a fully unionized workforce, and it makes money. And Warren Buffett's really happy with it and has no intention of selling it. And that's in Buffalo, New York, which has almost a quarter of its population unemployed. And yet the paper seems to make money and serve its civic obligation. So the story doesn't have to be this bad. And when we respect the work that reporters do, and we give them the time to learn about the world around them, they can do amazing things, even on very little time. Well, the problem now is that reporters can't even read books about the subjects they're supposed to cover.
Isn't that the problem, Lewis, that it's the lack of long-form journalism and the preparation, the prep time you need to actually do those sort of stories that is hurt? And isn't that why you follow
it? Well, not just long-form. Even like daily beat reporting is threatened by
and
this.
And again, we don't want to spend... we don't want to spend too much time on the print side of it but what is, I think, that the perception that print newspapers are on the verge of collapse. There was a premature prediction because these newspapers and actually no newspaper has folded in California that I'm aware of. Even the Daily Cal, at UC Berkeley, where I live, it's all, been predicting its demise for many. It's still going, and there still is there's very good journalism happening at many of those places, I spent a lot of time over the last year traveling around to newsrooms around the state to get newspapers involved in as partners with what we are doing, because we very much rely, we have an internet presence, but we also distribute to these other newspapers and we try to collaborate with them. I mean, we feel we have to operate on two tracks right now. We have to work with the existing media because really that is still where the eyeballs are, and even online.
The
circulations are declining. But the LA Times has 8 to 11 million unique visitors to their websites. The San Francisco Chronicle has about 4 or 5 million. And the other newspapers, going down the chain have, lesser amounts. But that is still a lot bigger than a lot of these newer websites that are emerging, including our own. At the same time, we can't be assured that those newspapers are going to be around in 5 or 10 years. Hopefully, we will be around. But also, we're also finding, and maybe we can get into this, that the distribution online gets you to a different audience and is very, very effective, much more effective than I could have anticipated in reaching particularly niche audiences. I tend to write a lot about education. I'm trying to reach an education community. The online-only news articles, in fact, We call them blogs. We don't call them blogs anymore. We call them news posts, because what we are doing is not opinion. And I think blogs imply, you know, you just got up in the morning and, you write about whatever comes to mind. And that's not true. I mean, there's such a tremendous range in these news products that are just being distributed on the web.
I think that's a really good point, because I think there's a tendency reflected even the title of this panel, as if to imagine that print and online forms exist in a strict binary, and the success of one means the other will disappear. And certainly that drives the conversation around books almost exclusively. So, you know, I work in a lot of ventures that produce new forms of digital writing, and in a university that mostly provokes in my humanities colleagues, you know, a very intense defense of the book. And I love books. I have a house full of them. I used to regularly accidentally get locked in libraries as a child because I'd be up there reading. You know, my 8-year-old reads voraciously. But just because I work in digital media forms doesn't mean I hate books, right? And it's not useful, I think, for us to continue to pretend that the rise of a new form means the death of an old. We know that McLuhan predicted print and books, newspapers and books, going away with the rise of television. And, you know, that didn't happen, right? So I think what we instead want to talk about is how you reach particular audiences with particular forms, how you educate students in particular to understand what the source of a story is and who owns that source, to be literate in algorithms. That may be the most important literacy we could provide youth today, is to understand how the information comes to them is often machinically generated, right? So rather than spend a lot of time imagining that, you know, newspapers will die because we have the Huffington Post, right? We might think about what's reconfigured and what our opportunities are and what our risks are. And I think that's a much richer conversation that might, you know, produce some tangible outcomes.
Yeah. Isn't there possibly a little bit of a back to the future element here? And this is listening to both of you. Michael Shudson at UCSD wrote a great book a few years back about the rise of objectivity in the journalistic profession, and basically the creation of the journalism profession and professionalism is a 20th century construct, a good one that I admire, but still a modern idea. And in many ways it seems to me what we've done in the last 10-15 years to go back a little bit to the late 19th century with the age of broadsheets and partisanship and, not knowing the source of things. And there's a little bit in common with that period, I think. What troubles me, and this is in part because, I'm always trying to establish, honest, credible, fact-based sources for things, is that, the thing that I spend a year working on that's fact-based, doesn't get the same sort of weight or less weight as something that's, a blog post and, that shows up first on Google. So it seems to me there has to be some balance between the gatekeeper element and the, lack of professionalism.
And I worry about the kind of bipartisanship that we know studies of the blogosphere produce, right? That even in the shift from listservs to blogs, the ability or frequency with which people crossed from reading what we might call left to right media or vice versa declined, right? Because the blogs tend to polarize their readerships more. But I also see what I think is different from the late 19th century is an enormous wealth of information at my fingertips. Mm-hmm. So I still read the LA Times, but I read voraciously across, my iPad and laptop screen as well from many different sources. And I work with, say, a lot of archival communities. And in the past, archives were places that protected and conserved their information. As a scholar, to get into an archive, you put on white gloves, you had your ID checked, you went into a small room. It was a nice ritual, but it meant the information in those archives was only accessible to a very limited few.
You got those little pencils.
Exactly.
That
you got
sharpened.
Searched when you left, right? And now, with the digitization of a lot of those resources, that archival material is open to, what we might call a whole set of citizen journalists, much like we now have citizen scientists. scientist. And I think that's enormously exciting and not something we should fear.
And it's so new that we haven't figured out how to do it right.
Yeah.
Right. So we have a wealth of raw material sitting in front of us at all hours of the day, and tremendous potential to bring it out in new forms. But we're really so new at it. We haven't learned how to adequately judge it. I'm very concerned about this notion that because there's a big dump of data out there that we pretend we can make sense of it.
Yeah.
And I think that the WikiLeaks collection brings this into the forefront. We actually don't know what WikiLeaks doesn't tell us, right? And we don't know what the WikiLeaks documents mean relatively, right? We don't know that if a document exists, it's a cable from someone in the Tunisian embassy 2 years ago, whether the event or the observation described in there has something that some other evidence that can back it up. There may be some missing evidence that contradicts it. There's really very few opportunities to measure the relative value of any particular piece of information, and we haven't really mastered that, right? So what I found was really scary about the notion that we have this tremendous amount of documentation, and we fetishize documentation sometimes, is that we were all Dick Cheney, right? Because what Dick Cheney did around 2003 was demand raw intelligence. He didn't want to trust the process of vetting and debating and certifying intelligence that our regular intelligence agencies had been up to very slowly over the years. He didn't trust the fact that they were checking facts. And so he and his office wanted raw material, which is exactly what now we are demanding through WikiLeaks. So I don't think it's a thoroughly healthy process, right, to just swim around in the raw data all the time. And I do think that one of the big challenges we have, much more than algorithmically, is, although we have to understand that, is just logically and culturally understand how to deal with vast amounts of data in all areas of knowledge.
Can I just, and I'm going to use the moderator's prerogative. I mean, this is great. We're going great, guys, but democracy. I mean, this is a panel on democracy. And so if you're looking at the, on the one side of the ledger, we're looking at print journalists, and there has been a decline. One thing we don't see at all, I mean, the two newspaper town is almost non-existent in most places in America. And so, you know, on the one level, I don't think that's what the founding fathers had in mind when they were talking about, you know, the First Amendment and a free press and so on, that you'd have one newspaper, because that doesn't seem very democratic, not many voices. So that's what's happening on the formal side. And, of course, there's also TV. I don't want to say that's the only source of information, even in one newspaper town. But then on the other side, there's just an enormous proliferation of outlets that people can just do their own thing. And just to extend in this education arena that I'm very involved in now, it's John Fensterwald, who used to be at the San Jose Mercury News. He got a grant from the Hewlett Foundation, and he has set up something called Educated Guess. And he is basically every day is putting out these, I call them news posts, they're not really blogs, but they're reported on education. And John is, you know, in a short period of time, he's established this is a place where people who are interested in education will really go. One person, he's basically set this thing up in like a year. This would not have been possible without this whole internet platform, you know, and you can just think about in terms of the pamphleteers and so on, that there's a tremendous opportunity for people who are pretty good at what they do and have some and focus in an area. I think you could have a tremendous impact. Now, the issue is who's going to fund this? I mean, John has a grant from the Hewlett Foundation, and, you know, I don't know how long that goes on for. Will it be sustained? So there is the who is going to support even the, you know, the people who are online who are doing good work. And we're going to go very shortly to your questions, but Leif, you had a
Well, I think it reminds me a little bit, in fact, the conversation of Chris Anderson of Wired, as you probably all know, wrote a book called The Long Tail, basically about how the internet allows the aggregation of, you know, what were formerly niche audiences or people who didn't know each other to, you know, become commercially viable affinity groups. And Lewis, when you're talking about, you know, getting in touch with people who are new about education, it strikes me, and I go back and forth on this, I can reach out, you know, on any abstruse subject in healthcare, anything, you know, physician reimbursement or particular kinds of hospital physician reimbursement. There is a blog and there are informed people out there. There are experts and amateur experts. And in many ways, the internet allows, you know, that those clustering of people in a way that could never happen before. The question for me, and this gets back to the, you know, the democracy issue, I mean, is having lots of affinity groups who basically butt up against each other but don't try to speak to one another that much a healthy phenomenon for democracy, because you're actually, you know, increasing the intensity of dialogue internally, or does it undercut the effort to explain, you know, general principles outside your particular specialty?
What you've both explained and described is actually very close to what the Founding Fathers lived through in the early days of the Republic. There were no professional newspapers with an authoritative voice. Everything was partisan. Everything was angry. Everything was sleazy. Everything was nasty, sleepy, dopey, whatever, right? So, and it was, like today, there was no shortage of diversity of opinion. And like today, there was too much diversity of fact. In other words, it was really hard to distill a fact. And this was one of the great challenges of the Enlightenment. It's one of the reasons that information organization and certification became a consuming passion of the Enlightenment, because it didn't exist. And and the reason that we have a handful of encyclopedias from the 18th century is a sort of desperate attempt to certify that some knowledge is true and others is merely fantasy. Other pieces of knowledge claims are purely fantasy. And so I reflect upon our first session when Professor Jameson brought up, in the plenary session, brought up the death panel debacle, right? This notion that this rumor that somehow in this great big health reform bill there was this instrument through which the government would decide who gets to live or die. I mean, just absurd stuff, right? I want to correct Professor Jameson a little bit in this. Twitter had nothing to do with that. It was, in fact, not 140 characters that caused that trouble.
It was actually Charles Grassley.
It was perpetuated by 24 hours of blather on a certain cable channel, which I wish were restricted to 140 characters at a time, right?
Yeah.
So the problem was not that we said too little and we spoke in sound bites. The problem was that people went on and on with lies, lies that were impossible to puncture in that environment. That's one of the things we're trying to figure out. In this sense, we're back to the 18th century, not just back to the 19th century, because we're trying to deal with this chaotic environment in which it is hard for the truth to win out over a lie. And this is one of our great challenges in a democracy. And until we get to the point where we can all sit around and admit that by the way, it is a fact that illegal immigration is lower now than it was under the previous administration. Imagine that, right? Unless we can accept that as a fact and then argue from that, unless we can accept as a fact that the health care bill is not a great government takeover and does not include death panels, we are hopeless. We can't move forward if we can't agree on basic facts. That instrumentality of professional journalism was never idealized. It was never fully realized. But we have less of it now than we've ever had before, partially out of the timidity of journalism and journalists, and partially out of the sort of culture of combat that we have. There are 100 different causes. I don't know of one solution.
Tara, I do want to ask you, because you are working with youth.
Yeah.
Young people in the digital.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason that despite knowing a lot about technology histories and the way the kind of initial promise of technologies has often been foreclosed, right? You can't work regularly with youth and see their excitement around digital media and what they could produce as citizen journalists, as critical synthesizers, as folks who have a platform for an audience, right? If you're around that, it's hard not to have an optimism, even if part of, you know, in the back of your head, you're still skeptical, right? Because youth are profoundly motivated by the possibility of achieving both an audience and working across media streams, right? And I think there's a very poignant opportunity in K-12 and university education to move from that motivation to engagement with broad civic questions, right? So my students, two of my colleagues have written extensively about critical synthesis as maybe the most important skill for the 21st century.
What is that?
That you learn to bring together multiple sources of information with a critical edge, right? So that you may be swimming in data, but you're not just accepting all of it. You're learning how to both process and judge that information and present it in compelling new forms. So my students need to be not only able to write and read very well, they need to be able to make a movie when that's the appropriate format. They need to know how in 140 characters to say what you want to say, right? And to be able to choose the medium that best suits the message they wanted to deliver to the world. And youth are ready to do that. You know, the public media library project that MacArthur has funded in Chicago, UMedia, at the Chicago Public Library, that place is hopping, right? You know, students are there all the time. It's a youth media center in the Chicago Public Library. A public RFP is about to go out for libraries and museums across the country to open similar spaces in their own facilities, right? So we have a... Because youth are fascinated by glowing screens, right, we have an opportunity to move that fascination toward a civic engagement that I think is fundamental to the future of democracy.
We're all fascinated by glowing screens, right, let's be honest.
And when that one lit up, we were
right. Can I just ask you, because, you know, I'm sure there's hardly any high school student, and forgive me if I know we had some high school student, it's possible that some are reading newspapers, but hardly any are. College students, I just never met a college student that actually, you know, would have a newspaper delivered. But they are accessing a lot of the information online. But where are young people then, I mean, getting their information? And are they getting the kind of substantive information that they need in order to make any kind of informed judgments about what's happening?
The answer to that is the same answer you would have when you look at America in general. If students have... if students have privilege, right, they have the time to read, they have access to the right technologies and the money to afford access to this stuff, then they do. And in fact, I mean, Tara and I both teach at elite institutions with privileged students. So our students are fully engaged in the worlds of information, fully engaged politically, and have the ability to teach us both a tremendous amount, which is why I'm jealous that your student said that particular thing. But I've got my own stories of brilliant students teaching me amazing things, right? So that's not typical, and that's all important to remember. The challenge we have is making sure that you can be a responsible and informed and engaged citizen at every income level in America. Yeah. We've never had that, right? Let's be honest. Right. We haven't even really had a functioning democracy in this country for even 40 years. I mean, before 1971, all adults in America couldn't vote. Before 1965, there were large portions of this country where people couldn't vote if they had dark skin.
What do you mean, the 71?
That's when we finally allowed people 18 to 21 to vote.
Okay.
Right? So until that point, we didn't really have a democracy. Mm-hmm. Since 71, we've had the ability to have
a
democracy.
Why not go lower?
Right?
Yeah. We have to go a little lower.
Yeah. No, so, I mean, it's one of those situations where we're just really learning how to function in a democracy. Yeah. We're barely there. We're just babies. We're learning to function with digital technology, something we've had in our lives for 10 to 20 years, right? We're just now learning to deal with tremendous global economic chaos, which we can no longer deny, right? We're being washed around by it constantly. We're dealing with the ramifications of some really profoundly stupid decisions in the 80s and 90s about how we will regulate or deregulate ourselves. And we're trying to make sense of this entire situation when basic human needs are still washing over us, when people still get tuberculosis and still get polio, and we haven't figured out how to deal with those things completely, right? So with all of these challenges, we have to remember that the problem of young people reading newspapers or not is trivial in that notion. But the real question is, are we fostering an information ecosystem that works for people at large and not just elite college students, because they can take care of themselves?
Can I? Okay, we're going to exercise some democracy here. Just I'd like to open it up for any Any questions? And it's hard to see, but yes, right here.
Yeah. Well, I could tell you the source for that.
Can I just repeat the question? It's Cornelius Moore is with California Newsreel, an early pioneer in film distribution and production over the years. Wants to know more about critical synthesis, how that actually works.
It came out of work at an institute at USC that I'm involved with called the Institute for Multimedia Literacy. And two colleagues, Steve Anderson and Anne Bosalmo, wrote an article for a series of MacArthur books on digital media and learning. And I edited one called Digital Innovation. And that essay is the last essay in that volume. They're available for free online. If you Google the MacArthur Digital Media Learning Initiative or My Name and Digital Youth, and try hard, you could find the free link. MIT Press kind of buried the free link behind the pay link, but it's there, right? So all the articles are there for free. And it's based on several years of thinking through how we support traditional literacies while also encouraging emerging literacies in our students. And they list a kind of number of things we should strive and kind of bring those together under a notion of critical synthesis that students actually really need to be able to evaluate information sources, but then bring that information together to create something greater than the sum of its parts, right? In the university in the past, we've tended to think originality was, you know, our sole goal. And I think, you know, actually what most academics have done was synthesize really well and hide their sources, right? And I think, you know, in the 21st century, learning how to kind of synthesize information in a way that's skeptical and critical is crucially important. Yeah.
So, but are they commenting on? I mean, I'm still not having an idea of what
how
it looks
works.
Like. Are they, you know, are they from whatever opinions they come to accept?
Right.
Commenting on.
Yeah, and then producing
Cornelius
quite often.
Cornelius asks, what are they actually, how does it actually
work? Yeah, and producing their own, learning how to choose between the forms of expression that are available to them to produce new information with the things that they have synthesized, right? So a lot of project-based education in which students survey a vast amount of information in a kind of problem field and then produce PSAs or scholarly articles or short documentaries or, you know, online web games, you know, sometimes alternate reality games, right? Thinking through a variety of information and then figuring out what's the best form to disseminate that information, right? So not unlike a lot of the kind of politicized work that's come out of, you know, California Newsreel and other places, like deciding what medium is the best one to get your message across after you've surveyed the facts you want to engage, right?
Right here.
We should repeat, try to repeat and summarize.
Yeah.
So she's curious about how we might spread this sense of engagement with material, this critical approach to the abundance of knowledge beyond the elite universities, and perhaps help younger students, K through 12 students, engage with this tremendous opportunity and develop these skills early in the face of imperatives coming from the bureaucracies that are sort of stultifying creativity in education, disrespecting teachers who actually want to engage with their students, et cetera. And so the question is, of course, how do we fix this problem?
Well, I teach a class every fall at USC called Digital Media and Learning, in which my undergrads, within 5 weeks, take over the course design, work with teachers at a local elementary school, and design with those teachers project-based technology assignments that we then implement in the elementary school classrooms. So my students are experiencing project-based learning by helping to take control of the classroom they've stepped into.
Can you just give an example of like what kind of project?
We worked with a lot of second graders at a Hollywood charter elementary school. It was studying what's up in our neighborhood as their theme, and we worked with them with digital mapping projects. So the students went out into the community with digital cameras and flip cameras that our students brought to them. They took pictures and documented, as reporters would, what they were seeing in their neighborhood. And then we went back to the classroom, and they pinned those on a map and annotated them on a platform called Community Walk, right? So we talked a lot about bird's eye view versus ground view, you know, how you do interviewing to find out about the people in the buildings in your neighborhood. And over the whole semester, the students continued to work with that map platform regardless of what they were studying across the year. Right?
You're second graders.
Second graders. Well, right.
Of course, none of this helps you excel on standardized tests, right? So how do you sell that beyond that? Right? So unfortunately, the answer to your question is really hard political work that we should have been doing 10 years ago and probably have to start doing now to instill respect and creativity in the teaching profession and in the culture of the school. It's going to be hard when every major foundation and billionaire in the country wants to sap all creativity from K through 12 education and disrespect teachers.
As we sit here today, the MacArthur Foundation is funding a conference in Long
Except
Beach
MacArthur
down
Foundation.
The road called Digital Media and Learning, right? That is, you know, trying to grapple with some of these questions and how you might work from the edge, right? So they fund those library projects partially because they're frustrated with the constraints of working within traditional schools, right? Mm-hmm. So they fund edge projects. They started a high school in New York that's based on games and game-like learning, run by Katie Salen. That's right. Amazing, and you know, now 2 years in. Right?
I would say though that these are not 21st century skills. These are 18th century skills in a 21st century context. The skills of judging information and making arguments and testing truth claims using a variety of logical methods is something we've been working on for three centuries. We're just not any better at it necessarily than we were three centuries ago. We may even be worse at it than we were 20 years ago. So these are not 21st century skills. It's just a different environment.
I do really think we need to understand computer code and algorithms, right? That needs to be a fundamental literacy. In the 80s, there was a moment in which we taught students how computers worked pretty regularly in elementary schools, and we don't do that anymore. And they will be victims to the Googleization of everything if they cannot understand how their computers work behind the screen.
I like that.
And I mean, what I'm also struck by is that there's so many levels here that has to be dealt with. We're talking about what do we do, how do we engage young people and to use these new media tools more effectively and so on. But then there's also the issue of how do we engage the public in these just basic information that's required to be citizens. And if I can just, you know, California, we're just at this moment in the next 2 weeks, I mean, aside from what's going to happen in Washington, about whether there's going to be a special election and which, you know, is going to have dramatic impact on the schools. And at this point, things are not looking so good in that regard. But where are all these, how are we going to educate voters? I mean, literally in the next, you know, few months about what actually is happening in the state level. So anyway, just to put that out there.
We didn't do too well in the 2000, I don't know if you remember back in 2009, there was a special election and we went around the state trying to educate people on all the ballot measures and found levels of ignorance that were even deeper than the ones that you're suggesting there in that poll. But it is, as Max Weber said about politics, it's the slow boring of hard boards. Slow boring of hard boards. And I don't mean to be negative there, but hard. But one other thing that you know what you're talking about suggests is that there are, you know, it's not easy, but it's possible for great individual educators to create terrific pockets of critical thinking or whatever critical thinking, whatever guise it goes under. But it's incredibly difficult to get funding society-wide for that kind of effort, even if at some level we know that's what's necessary. And that's difficult in the political process. And I see the political process pretty close up, and it's very mundane, day-to-day, power-oriented. And it's not about thinking in these terms whatsoever.
So we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
Immense.
I wanted to thank the panel for a fantastic discussion, and thank you for your patience. in a late Friday afternoon. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.